United States of America versus Cassandra Thomas, cause number 12-60707, and we have Mr. Gibbs.
Good morning. Yeah, I am Robert Gibbs, representing Dr. Cassandra Thomas, who was convicted of 10 counts of health care fraud. It's our contention today, Your Honors, that Dr. Thomas was indicted, tried, and convicted of a confusing and ambiguous Medicare statute as well as the regulations. And I want to start by calling this Court's attention to its decision in Jones, United States versus Jones, which was a 2011 case that was decided by this Court. In that particular case, a situation very similar to the one that we have here was before the Court. The Court looked at an individual by the name of Thad Pearson who ran a clinic similar to the one that was being operated by Dr. Thomas. In that case, Mr. Pearson used unlicensed clinologists, who the Court abbreviated as KTs, to provide treatment in homes of homebound patients under the exception, the homebound exception to the Medicare rules. This Court said in that opinion that the Medicare regulations were ambiguous. And this is the same Medicare regulation that we're dealing with here. The Court did not decide that issue because the Court decided that there was other issues in the case in which the conviction could be upheld.
Isn't that what we have here in terms of these other factors in this prosecution, for instance, improper billing? Or didn't Jones comment upon that?
Your Honor, there was, those issues didn't go to the jury. The things that went to the jury dealt with whether or not Dr. Thomas was providing treatment in the homes of homebound patients in undeserved areas without direct supervision. And if you look at the pretrial ruling of the lower
court, how could she really legitimately think she can charge doctor rates for these people that have very limited training and are providing very limited services?
Because the Senate Finance Committee, when they made the allowance for 2051A of the carrier manual, they looked at that very issue. And they said that in those situations, in rural areas, underserved areas, where there's a shortage of doctors, a shortage of health care, and there are broad areas of coverage, the Senate Finance Committee decided that they would allow for those individuals in those homes to be served by personnel who did not have to be licensed.
But if there was a factual issue, and from my reading of the record, they were, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a factual issue of whether or not these services were medically unreasonable or unnecessary, right? So
well,
isn't that distinguishing enough on the Jones?
Well, the government tried to put on proof that they were not reasonable. The defendants put on proof that Dr. Thomas or other personnel went into the homes, evaluated those patients, and determined that the services that were prescribed was indeed necessary and reasonable. So there was proof in the record that that was done. Of course, it was the government's position that you can't have those services in the homes without the doctor going there and they are being reasonable and necessary. We disagree with that assessment. But again, the problem is not so much as whether or not it was right or wrong, it's whether or not Dr. Thomas had any knowledge that it was right or wrong because the ambiguity of the statute and other regulations. Again, if you go through the regulations, there are some regulations that deal with direct supervision. And the trial judge, and one of the problems in this case was the trial judge in a pretrial motion took a lot of time, a lot of effort in researching a lot of the issues and ultimately determined that what Dr. Thomas did was illegal. And so it tied her hands at trial on what she could prove, particularly about her knowledge and particularly about the confusing nature of the statutes. And if you look at the lower court's ruling, he even said that Dr. Thomas' position of her interpretation of these rules was futile and he used another word, too. Basically, he said that when this is a knowledge or whether or not she intended to do it, the lower court basically determined that her interpretation of those statutes were absurd. He said they were absurd and futile. So how can she put on a case to try to show that she reasonably relied upon an interpretation of the statute that we believe is reasonable if the trial judge has already determined that it's futile and absurd? And if you look at his ruling throughout that, he tied Dr. Thomas' hands at trial where she could not put on a case. He had already determined that you can't go into the home of a homebound patient with unskilled or untrained or unlicensed personnel and then bill Medicare. He had already made that determination.
Well, it's less about billing them and more about billing them at the physician rate. People that are being paid $20 an hour and who have very limited skills providing very limited services. And this isn't something where somebody who's a nurse's, these people that have masters in nursing and they go in, they're virtually a physician themselves. That might be a different, better case for this ambiguity, but you send somebody there to provide very limited, almost menial help and charge that at the physician rate, and you're going to tell me that the ambiguity, she just really didn't know that was against the law?
Well, Judge, again,
she's
look
a doctor.
At
the, she's
which,
an
was,
educated
which was the Jones case. Jones acknowledged that, but found that that was still proper.
Well, no, sir, it did not find that it was proper. It acknowledged that there was ambiguity in the statute.
Didn't Jones say that, like your client saying, they did not knowingly render services improperly because the Medicare regulations governing use of unlicensed providers were ambiguous?
That's exactly what it said, but if you look at the ruling of the court said we were not going to get to that decision because they found that there was time billing issues that they could also find a conviction of.
Well, here there are reasonableness and necessity issues. And I just think a gross mismatch between what she's billing for and what's really being provided by who is providing it. I mean, so this is, to me, much beyond, I'm basically doing the work of a doctor, I just don't have the doctor's license, you know, what's the circumstance there? This is very far removed from that, it seems to me.
But Judge, that's exactly what the problem was. Dr. Thomas was not able to get in there and explain it because the trial judge pretty much said what you said, that he didn't see how you could do that. But that's not what a trial is about. A trial is an opportunity to put on.
What specific evidence was she not allowed to put on that she made a proffer on and the judge said you can't put this evidence on?
Well, number one, she wanted to put on some documents. I think it was a document written by David Blanks, who was one of the prosecution attorneys in the case, who had written an article back in 2009 that explained that you didn't have to have licensing requirements for those individuals to go into the homes and that there was confusion in the Medicare community about the requirements of licensing for those individuals.
Okay. So that was an exhibit that was not admitted. What was the exhibit number? What was the record site that we can go look at that exhibit?
All right. I have it cited in my brief, Judge. If you give me a minute, I'll tell you exactly what it was. But that was one of the articles. It was in the record at 647 through 655 is the attempt to put it in the record.
Okay.
And I'm sorry,
That's fine. Anything else that you attempted to put on that you think would buttress this ambiguity defense that was excluded?
That was a 2004 article, and let me see if I can find that site, which went to the, and that's in the record also at 647, where the federal government decided to address the problem of revisions to clarify the Medicare and Medicare regulations. And again, they chose to say that auxiliary personnel who was providing physical therapy services, they came in 2005 and said they had to possess the same education and skill levels as licensed physical therapists. But prior to 2004, there was miscommunication in the Medicare community about whether or not that was appropriate or not. And Dr. Thomas wanted to put on that, but the judge in the pretrial ruling again said that because there was no reliance on that, because it came after Dr. Thomas closed her clinic, because there was no reliance on that, she could not use it.
But wouldn't Thomas's own argument hinge on the allegedly unclear nature of the importance of state licensing in the context of Medicare regulations governing physical therapists?
Well, no, Judge, because, again, that's the ambiguity. If you look at the carrier's manual, the exception for homebound patient, I think it's 2051A, it allows a limited exception if you're in an underserved area, and it was stipulated at trial that the areas that Dr. Thomas service was underserved areas, that you don't have to have direct supervision of the doctor over those persons that go in. And the issue was whether or not there had to be any state requirements. And Dr. Thomas wanted to put on proof that, again, that was confusing because in certain instances, you didn't have to have licensing requirement. And that was what these articles were talking about. But the judge ruled that you did. He ruled that because it said any pertinent requirement, that that meant that you had to have a license to go into these homes. And again, that's an ambiguity of the issue, which I believe is what the court looked at in Jones. Because in Jones, the KTs that went into the homes were unlicensed. And at trial, they wanted to put on proof that those unlicensed KTs, you could bill for those services in the home of homebound patients in underserved areas under 2051 of the carrier's manual. And the court found that that was ambiguous. And we're dealing with the same thing here.
What about evidence of waiving the copayments and also of overstating the time?
Judge, those did not go to the jury. Look at the jury instructions. Look at what the court instructed the jury on. Those were factors in the case, but those issues didn't go to the jury. What went to the jury was whether or not Dr. Thomas should have been billing under a direct supervision. The government position was throughout the trial, and I believe the trial judge also believed that you had to have direct supervision to go into the homes of these homebound patients in underserved areas and to bill Medicare for those services. And that's just not what the carrier manual allowed in those instances. And the carrier manual also did not say that you had to be licensed during the time that Dr. Thomas ran her clinic. And that evidence, again, was not allowed because the court, in a pretrial motion, cut Dr. Thomas' opportunity to present that. So we believe that because of the ambiguity of the statutes, that the court has to apply the rule of lenity so that the conviction can be thrown out.
You've got a few more minutes left. You want to talk about the sentencing issue. There's no question the district court found that she was absent, wasn't clear whether or not she had an express waiver or even advice concerning that. He chose to believe, I think, in post-trial motion hearings, your client's position.
Judge, in my opinion, that is an issue that we should win. Dr. Thomas had a Rule 43 right, as well as a Fifth and Sixth Amendment right, to be present at every critical stage of the trial, and she was not. It's clear in the record that she was present when the jurors was questioned during the voir dire. Then the court took a recess, and the court said, after the recess, I'm going to meet with the attorneys in my chambers. And during the chamber conference, that's when the peremptory challenges were taken up, that's when the challenges for cause were taken up, and that's when the jury was impaneled. Dr. Thomas was not present, nor did the court inquire as to why she was not present, nor did the court ask her and get an on-the-record waiver from her. So she was absent during that critical part of the trial.
Does it make a difference if there's some evidence to suggest that it would not have made of a difference? Although she says she wanted to be there specifically, I think, to have a black male on the jury.
She said that in the court in a post-trial ruling on a Strickland issue, said that she did not show prejudice. But, Judge, this is a fundamental constitutional right.
So it makes no difference whether or not it would have changed the outcome or not?
I believe the law is very clear that if it's a fundamental constitutional right, you have to have an on-the-record waiver for it, and the waiver has to be knowingly and intelligently made.
Yeah, but the problem is on plain – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, so your position, this is a structural error?
Yes,
no,
ma'am.
And no prejudice is required?
That's my position, Your Honor, because, again, under Rule 43, and cases from this court, the United States versus Alipo case, U.S. versus Curtis, that this court has decided, you decided that that's a critical stage of the prosecution, and the defendant has a right to be there.
But there's a lot of rights that are critical that we still apply plain error review to. You're saying that there doesn't have to be an objection, anything like that, and we still, it's just like an automatic reversal. If we find it happened, it's an automatic reversal. That's your argument, in essence.
That's my argument, Your Honor. In this case,
and that's based on what case?
You said it in U.S. versus Lipo, and I can give you that site. Where a defendant was not present during a critical part of the trial, which included the impoundment of the jury. And this court found that that critical right was violated. That's 944 Fed Second 206. Your Honor, again, that's a fundamental constitutional right that's not only provided by the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, but also by Rule 43. And Rule 43, and there's cases to this effect that we cited as well, said that, and I know my time is up.
You've got a red light, but you have saved time for rebuttal, so yes. we'll hear back from you shortly.
Thank you.
Mr. Cleveland.
Good morning, Your Honor. Gaines Cleveland for the government. Dr. Thomas billed Medicare and Medicaid for physical therapy services that she neither provided nor supervised. As Judge Haynes observed, she billed at her doctor's rate, suggesting she provided the physical therapy herself or directly supervised the services. Her unlicensed personnel were paid a fraction of what properly trained professionals would earn. By not collecting co-payments, she didn't have to worry about patients complaining about the cost of the services, which were grossly inflated.
Oh, let me ask you about that. Your counsel opposite says that that was not part of the jury instruction, so we can't consider this issue of the overbilling in time-wise or the co-payment issue. What's your response to that?
Judge, those are aspects of the health care fraud that were encompassed by the indictment. The indictment, paragraph 8G, talks about Medicare payments being premised on all other general requirements being satisfied. As far as the billing, that was included specifically in the indictment of paragraph 18. It lists the codes that the 15-minute codes that were also referred to in Government Exhibit 13. Proof was developed extensively at trial on the copayment issue, on the billing issue. If you look at the facts section of the government's brief, you'll see the citations to the record. The judge did not take away that issue.
So you're saying in terms of the general instructions, it was before the jury?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they could consider these other issues besides just the use of the unlicensed people.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that would be similar to the Jones case that this court decided, and therefore there are other aspects of the fraud that were before the jury. In the closing, on the issue of copayments, government counsel said if the defendant had collected the copayment, they wouldn't have had any patients, because it would have cost so much for people to use these services because of the way they were inflated. There were references repeatedly to the overbilling, to the high number of units. That's transcript at 1034 on both of those points.
Okay, so let me
do you recall?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Just real quickly, do you recall which counts specifically dealt with the copayments and the overbilling, the overcharging for hours that weren't actually worked?
All of the counts talked about healthcare fraud, and this is part and parcel of the fraud. It would go to all of the counts, Your Honor.
I just want to understand on the copay. Was a copay due every time one of these therapists, and I'll put that in quotes, would visit?
Yes.
Okay. And was there some sort of maximum on that after
20%.
A period of time?
It was a 20%.
No, I mean, like my insurance, for example, once I've paid some amount of money, I don't have to pay anything anymore.
I'm not an expert on that aspect of it, but I don't believe I saw any reference to that in the transcript.
So every time a therapist, and we'll put that in quotes, would show up, there should have been a copay, and this would go on the whole year, let's say, with that patient. And you're saying because that wasn't charged, the patient was just too happy to have
absolutely,
you know, Mr. X show up at their door and do little exercises with them or whatever they were doing.
A lot of these were basically free massages. So this was a way of inducing the patients to come in. It's free.
So from the Medicare standpoint, Dr. Thomas would make it look like she did charge the copay, but she just wouldn't. So if she charged 120 in total, then she would just charge Medicare 100 and say she charged 120, but just never collect that 20 from the patient.
She didn't. She instructed people involved in billing not to bill copay.
Right, but what I'm saying is, did she tell Medicare she had done that, or how did she, you know, prove that with
them?
I think it was
not addressed specifically in the record. And I think the assumption is that the person who is billing is collecting the copay.
Okay.
So you have, throughout the period of the indictment, this Medicare requirement of direct supervision, as well as these additional requirements that were referred to in the indictment. It's our position that there was no ambiguity. This direct supervision requirement was clearly set forth in the Code of Federal Regulations. It's 42.410.26b2. It remained unchanged throughout the period of the indictment. In order to be incident to a doctor's care, required direct supervision by the doctor. So when a claim is submitted by a physician, the doctor, under the doctor's billing number, the doctor is making this representation that the doctor performed or directly supervised. The only exception is for services to the homebound, but that requires personnel meeting any pertinent state requirements. Dr. Thomas didn't qualify for this exception because none of her personnel was licensed under Mississippi law. She says, well, her personnel were
formed. Now, what about this argument that there's some ambiguity about Mississippi law and the argument that she wasn't allowed to present that to the jury, her good faith belief in this ambiguity?
This issue was fully presented to the jury. In government exhibit 16, this included all of the relevant aspects of the Mississippi law, including Government Exhibit 16C, which is the provision that Dr. Thomas relies on, which is that her personnel were performing only simple procedures and therefore they were not subject to the physical therapy requirement. It's Mississippi Code section.
Which is kind of counter to her argument that she thinks she can charge a doctor's rate for people performing services so simple they don't even need a license.
Exactly. And in fact, on cross-examination, she herself said that these services didn't need a doctor to perform or a physical therapist to perform them. This is transcript at 996 to 997. The Medicare is very specific on this.
So is the only evidence that she claims that was excluded was this article by the some prosecutor or a public?
This article, which was... In fact, on their list, Defendant's Exhibit 6, it was not offered at trial.
We had a motion in limine, a ruling, but no offering at that
time. It was never renewed at the time of trial.
You say the error wasn't preserved.
That's correct. Okay. There was the new regulations that went into effect in 2005 and a Federal Register discussion of that, and the judge did not allow that into evidence, but he allowed them to bring out the fact that the regulations were changed in 2005, which was after the time period of the conduct that we're talking about.
And she was making that point to show that they had been previously ambiguous and
That's
were
correct.
Now being clarified?
That's
okay.
correct.
But so she got to make that point, is what you're saying?
That's correct. And there was a good faith instruction, so we do think that the defense had a full opportunity to present this. And of course, just one more point on the simplicity of the services. The Medicare manual, Government Exhibit 12, stated, this is cited in our brief at page 26, that services which do not require the performance or supervision of the physician are not reasonable and necessary. On the subject of the defendant's participation in the conferences, this would be a plain error. The Curtis case that the defendant referred to talks about it in a plain area. This is not error. This is not an absolute right. It's a right that exists to the extent it's necessary to to allow the defendant to have an opportunity to express her views.
I don't think there's any question that if the judge had thought about it, would have made sure that she was there for any part of jury selection. I think this was kind of one of those things, let's all go back to chambers, and nobody really pays much attention to the fact that the defendant doesn't come back. She may have misunderstood that, you know, chambers and attorneys and all of that. So I think it was just a mistake, but the question is how we view it now on appeal, what standard review and so on.
Well, it would be a plain error standard. The court would need to look at what the error was. Now, as far as the jury selection is concerned, this is not an absolute right. And let me grab one thing. In the Gagnon case, which we cite at our brief at 45, talks about the due process right being to the extent a fair and just hearing would be thwarted by the defendant not being there. To that extent only, this is not an absolute right. It's a right that's contingent on really what the defendant could contribute. And our position is that she had every opportunity to express herself on the subject of the prospective jurors before she had an opportunity to go, before they went into this conference. And the judge said this specifically, that there was, quote, ample time, close quote, for her counsel to meet with her before jury selection began. That's at the record at 1895.
Would you remind me, was the striking, the peremptory challenges, or were they done orally or were they handed up to like a court deputy?
This was done, as best I can tell from the record, in the chambers.
Okay.
It was done orally. The judge told the courtroom deputy who was present the name of the list, the names on the list. The courtroom deputy was instructed to go out in the courtroom and get the jury in place. So the presumably.
So at that point, if she's like, well, say what? I mean, we've got this, why has nobody asked me about these people getting a panel? That was the time for her to make some comment to her lawyer or raise the issue. She would know that.
She would know that. Yeah. And they were not sworn until after the lunch break. So there was plenty of opportunity for her to raise a point to her lawyer, to raise a point to the court, and she didn't do so.
I thought we do have cases on point that say had she been excluded from voir dire, that's a problem, but not exclusion from peremptory challenges is not a problem. I thought somebody cited cases to that effect.
The Curtis case, which is in the briefs, talks about the two requirements being present for the voir dire, and she was present for the entire voir dire. Unlike the vast majority of the cases that the defendant has cited, where the defendant was not present for some or all of the voir dire because some of the voir dire was conducted at sidebar or in some other way, she was present for all of the voir dire. The language is talked about when the strikes are given effect. Now, I don't know how the court wants to interpret that, but there are circuit decisions from around the country where they talk about when the clerk reads the names off, and there are others that talk about when the judge reads the names off. I'm not sure it matters who reads the names off. It's done in open court, the names are read, the jury is seated, and in this case, the defendant had an opportunity to be present, presumably was present when the jury was, the names were called. She came, she had an opportunity to talk to her lawyers before the jury was actually sworn, which was after the lunch break. So we do think that we satisfied that. And that's cited in our brief at page 35. And the Gales case from the Eighth Circuit is one of the ones where it's the clerk reading the names as opposed to the judge. There's nothing that she's pointed to that she could have added to what she already was able to tell her lawyers. She said in the post-trial hearing at page 3284 of the record, I told them what I wanted before they went back. She didn't complain about the juror number 17, the former postmaster that she said she would have stricken. She was present in the courtroom when that juror was questioned, had an opportunity to hear everything he had to say. She had an opportunity to see this the so-called napping juror who she said she would have given coffee to that juror. Well, she was present and could have given him coffee. So
I wish it were that simple to wake up sleeping jurors.
So our position is she had nothing that she could have contributed to at the jury selection, at the time of the questioning of the jurors about the outside contacts, nor about the jury note, which was purely a question of law, as to which her presence is accepted under Rule 43b-3. Our position overall is that Judge Durden was very careful in presiding over the proceedings, considering the issues both before and after trial, and that the conviction should stand.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Gibbs?
Your Honor, let me address the issues about presence in the courtroom and talk about this court's opinion in U.S. versus Alipo. In that particular case, defendant was not in the courtroom during a portion of the voir dire. This court in this opinion said, and it looked at the fundamental right to be present at all stages of the trial. The court looked at Rule 43 and held that one of the most basic of the rights guaranteed by the Confrontation Clause is the accused's right to be present in the courtroom at every stage of the trial. The court then noted that while the right is waivable, the defense counsel who made an ambiguous response out of the defendant's presence, the court found that that did not suffice as a valid waiver. And that's pretty much what we have here. Dr. Thomas did not get advice from her counsel, and we raised that as another issue, and I know we hadn't had a chance to talk about it, but the ineffectiveness of her counsel. Her counsel did not tell her that she had a right to go in chambers. The court instruction was that we're going in with the lawyers. Dr. Thomas did instruct her counsel on what she wanted in a jury, but had she been there, she would have been able to explain it to him. The case of U.S. Versus Gordon is a D.C. Circuit case, and I know I hate to read things to the court, but it said in that case that a defendant's presence at jury selection is also necessary so that he may effectively exercise his peremptory challenge. The process of peremptory challenges is essential to an impartial trial. Dr. Thomas was not there when that happened. And she has said in affidavits and in her post-trial testimony of what she would have liked to have been, that she would have liked to have been in chambers and would have made a meaningful contribution to that. The court found that she did not waive it. Matter of fact, her lawyer lied to the court in another conference and said that he had advised her that she didn't have to be there, and she said that was fine.
Even if I agree with you, perhaps, that it was plain error to not have her present for the challenges, even though she was present for most of the voir dire, it seems to me that there is something in this record which indicates, given her statement that she wanted to have a black male on that jury, that she wanted to be present for impermissible purposes. Batson would have not allowed that if she would have just struck a white juror just to get a black juror on board. Is that a fair analysis, saying that even though you may be right, plain error for not being present, but for impermissible purpose?
Well, I don't know if it's impermissible to have an input on the type of juror you wanted, particularly if there's an opportunity.
There's no equivocation on that on her part. She said she wanted a black male.
She did.
She didn't say, well, this white male shouldn't be on here for X non-prohibited reason.
Well, she did say that, too, because the white male that she did not want on there was an OIG postal inspector.
But in general sense, though, that wouldn't have led automatically, at least nothing in this record, to show that that would have led to a black juror being on board, is there?
And Judge, I don't disagree with you, but the fact of the matter is Dr. Thomas was the defendant. Her future was at stake. She knew in her mind the type of jury that she wanted to have to decide her fate. She did not get that because she was not present to have input on that decision. And the United States versus Gordon case talks about that very situation and how important it is for the defendant to be there to have that input. Whether that was permissible or not, you may be right that it's an impermissible reason. But to have the input to make that decision, she was deprived of it. And, of course, as I said, I'm sorry.
Okay.
In the case
would you,
in,
would you address the argument back on the indictment, would you address the argument that the services being provided were so simple and so simplistic that no reasonable physician could have thought or would have thought that supervision was necessary?
Yeah, I go back to the indirect versus direct and general supervision. Again, when the Senate Finance Committee decided that in these rural areas that are underserved, you can't have doctors going to all of those homes. You have to
but
use...
The point is that a massage is not something the physician would normally say, that needs my supervision, even indirectly.
Well, but Dr. Thomas and her personnel assessed those individuals to determine what was reasonably necessary. And in some instances, it was decided that they needed therapeutic massages. And that is one of the allowances that under 2051 of the carrier's manual you can do in underserved areas. That is permissible. And there's nothing in the record that says you have to have a license to do that during the time period that Dr. Thomas was operating.
Okay. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
You have a red light.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate both sides, and we will take that case under submission.